Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and so much more. This week, we have a report from the Cannes Film Festival. Stephen Garrett is there this year, as he is every year, and he saw the world premiere of Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis, which is getting lots of lively reviews online, and Stephen's going to offer up his take on it for us and also talk to us about other things that are going on in France at the moment. We're also going to talk to, right now, we're going to talk to Omar Gayaga, Book and Film Globe contributor who has become somewhat of an expert on nuclear apocalypse of late. And yet, this will not be a depressing conversation. It'll be an interesting conversation about the new TV show Fallout on Amazon Prime and also a new book about what would happen in case of a nuclear strike. So Omar will be right back after this non-apocalyptic musical interlude to talk to me about these things. Book and Film Globe contributor Omar Gayaga has become a sort of an expert on nuclear apocalypse in recent weeks. It was a surprising turn for Omar's career. Omar tends to cover comedy and film and TV for us, but has recently developed a little obsession with the apocalypse. I think largely due to this book you reviewed for us, Omar.
Yeah, I took a look at Annie Jacobson's Nuclear War, a scenario, which came out, I believe, in March or April. Part of the reason I even took a look at that book that it interested me, apart from the subject matter, was that it was optioned for a film for Dune director Denis Villeneuve. So we might be seeing a movie version of this, and I had just, I had just seen Dune 2. I was like, oh wow, this guy might actually make something interesting with this property. But it's a fictional version of what would really happen in a nuclear war. Very well researched. Annie Jacobson is a Pulitzer Prize finalist. She's a very, very, she's got a lot of Pentagon people and defense people as her sources. She talks to former secretaries of state. She talks to a lot of experts in the area of nuclear science, nuclear policy, to put together this sort of second by second account of like what would happen if North Korea launched a single intercontinental ballistic missile at DC and also at a power plant in Southern California, a nuclear power plant. So we have these two missiles incoming and sort of the second by second breakdown of what's happening at the Pentagon, what's happening at the, in Moscow, what's happening underground in North Korea, like all of these different places, and you learn a lot about like how these missiles work, how the defense systems work, what's the Pentagon policy on a nuclear, like what would we do in response in that situation? What would the president do? It's terrifying. It's a really scary book, but I also felt like it's very necessary reading to know what would actually happen. What's the worst case? What would we actually do? And what's survivable or not survivable about the scenario?
Well, it's interesting because I feel like Annie Jacobson's book is kind of a throwback to an earlier era of I wouldn't say nuclear alarmism because she's not being alarmist, but of nuclear awareness, right? Like, when I was growing up, you're a bit younger than me, but the nuclear war scenarios played out in very vivid detail in The Day After, the ABC television movie, which terrified a generation, about nuclear war, and also Threads, which is the British version of The Day After, which is even more terrifying and more horrible, if that's even possible, than The Day After. I rewatched The Day After fairly recently for a piece for another publication. And, it was just as chilling and terrible, even more so in some ways, upon a rewatch in the modern day. So Annie Jacobson's book takes us back to that era where, there was a time when we were aware that the nuclear bombs were going to kill us all.
Yeah, I was part of that generation. I think Annie Jacobson was too. That I saw that at a very formative age. I saw The Day After and Threads, and I think I even saw Testament, which was sort of a more low key, like TV movie style version of what would happen.
That also was more scary.
More focused on the aftermath than the actual war. But Yeah, and that also informs her book. She does mention that what has happened is, you know, we were all terrified in the 80s. We had this sort of movement toward disarmament where, you know, we did reduce the number of missiles, us and Russia. But since then, it's gotten even scarier because, like, you know, after the Cold War, we stopped thinking about it. We stopped thinking it was a danger or that it was imminent. But now we have many more players with missiles. We have, you know, we have your North Koreas, we have India, we have other people that now have this technology. Pakistan, absolutely.
Do you really want India and Pakistan, you know, with their history facing each other with nukes? Israel has nukes. That may be relevant to contemporary conversation. You know, and of course, Russia, China, and the United States are all still nuclear powers, and possibly at some point Iran, and that's really scary.
Right, and the other thing that's happened is since around 2017. And she details this, you know, this is all detailed in the book. Like you will be an expert by the time you finish this book on all these things, is that Korea has been building these underground tunnels. They've been doing nuclear testing. They have a satellite up in the sky right now that they're saying is just, you know, a weather satellite or something, you know, innocuous, but it's probable that there's an EMP weapon on that, an electromagnetic pulse weapon that if it was above the United States and activated, it would basically just wipe out our entire electrical grid, you know, cars, power plants, traffic lights, you know, it would be just mass chaos if that were to go off in the middle of this type of scenario. And that's sort of the North Korea is sort of the instigator in her book is, you know, that is who's behind it. And she describes the leader of North, she doesn't go into specific names. She doesn't name Putin or you know, specific people, but she calls him the Mad King, you know, this just a person in North Korea with a grudge who wants to show the world, you know, that he's got power and that's all it takes to kind of end the world.
Right. Well, that's great news, Omar. Thanks for sharing. You know, and I think that was it's interesting because you wrote about this for us and also you had a piece in the LA Times talking about the Annie Jacobson book and you tied it in to the show that is now on streaming called Fallout, which is an adaptation of a post-nuclear apocalypse video game. And, you know, when you talk – it's interesting when you talk about Fallout is that you know, Fallout is fun, right? Like it's a fun, you know, rollicking post-nuclear adventure, which stands in stark contrast to, you know, post-nuclear material like The Road, the Cormac McCarthy book, which was also a very, very depressing post-nuclear movie, whereas Fallout is full of monsters and you know, faceless cowboys and all kinds of cool robots.
Yeah, a lot of stretching science a bit. 200-year-old ghouls and people, you know, just losing a leg and then getting better with an injection. Like, you know, a lot of like futurey kind of like fake science. What was happening was I was reviewing Fallout for you. I was watching those episodes and I was consuming the audiobook of Nuclear War at the same time as I was traveling. I was on, you know, on the road traveling and kind of watching the episodes and listening to the audiobook in between and actually flying. At one point I flew through Washington, D.C. as I was listening to the audiobook, which was really fucking creepy because D.C. is the main target in the book, the Pentagon. And so I just had this very wild cognitive dissonance going back and forth between those two things. And at first, I've told people this, like it almost ruined Fallout for me because I was trying to enjoy Fallout, which is very, you know, over the top and silly. And all I could think was like, that's not what would happen. That's not, you know, none of us would survive. That's absolutely untrue. Like that, and I had to kind of just put that aside and accept that Fallout is a fantasy based on a video game,
right?
And not meant to be scientifically accurate. So once I got past that roadblock, I was able to enjoy both of them. Fallout is a great show, but it is nothing remotely accurate about what a nuclear war would be like.
Right. Like if people somehow managed to escape to these bunkers and they were to come out after 200 years, there would just be desolation, right? There wouldn't be wacky mutants floating around.
No, you couldn't even be out in the sun. I mean, if the ozone layer would be gone, you'd you know, your skin would get cancer immediately if even just being outside. And you know, it would take tens of thousands of years to for the Earth to kind of heal itself. That was the one reassuring thing in the book, actually, toward the end. It's like, you know, once the humans are gone, like the Earth will be fine. The Earth has survived stuff like this before. It survived the end of the dinosaurs. It'll go on without us. So that
right. Eventually, the atmosphere will regenerate. The air will clear. The seas will clear, and life will go on. It just won't be our just, society as
we just aren't likely to be around for that. Yeah.
Yeah. There will be no more takeout from Sonic, for instance. That's just one thing that we would lose. That's probably the least important thing that we would lose.
Everyone I told about this book is like, how could you even make it through that book? It's so depressing. That sounds awful. There's something a little kind of like the band Tool, like their music is very nihilistic. And it's like, it's kind of reassuring to think about how bad things could get and that we wouldn't have to worry about all these things anymore.
It's okay. You want to face your fears, Omar. That's fine. I mean, I certainly have no interest. As far as I'm going to go is talking to you about the book and reading your writing on the book. I feel like I get it, and I thank you for your service. I am not a nuclear war denier. I understand that it exists, but I also am like, well, you know, there's no point in me really sitting around worrying about it. There's nothing I can do to stop whatever march of history is about to envelop us. Let's just hope that saner heads prevail. You know, that's all you can really hope for in these scenarios.
Yeah, I mean, the whole policy of deterrence is that it works until it doesn't. You know, if everyone decides it's too crazy to do that, then we're fine. But it only takes one, you know, mad king to kind of mess with that and ruin it for everybody. But that is a pretty central point of the book toward the end, is that we are not thinking about it anymore. And in that not thinking about it, things have actually gotten quite a bit more precarious. Things have gotten, you know, worse in the last, you know, I would say 10 years. As we've sort of just not thought about it and not considered it.
Well, but now because of this book, though, we are thinking about it. I'm sure if you're thinking about it, and if I don't like to think about anything, if I'm thinking about it, then there may be people whose thoughts actually mean something who are thinking about it as well. And maybe this book is actually like a real public service.
I hope so. I mean, you said that it's not an alarmist book. I think it's very alarmist. I think she's definitely like trying to sound the alarm and let us know that this is not okay for us to be in this situation and hope that it doesn't happen.
It's like a post-Cold War Silent Spring in some ways.
For sure. Yeah. I think she's hoping that it will create a little bit of activism and maybe some move toward more disarmament and thinking more about, you know, the consequences of this. So I think that's the point of the book, I hope.
Well, we thank Annie Jacobson for that. Her book, Nuclear War, A Scenario, is available wherever books are sold. And Fallout, which is also like a really fun show. It's lots of, you know, a really rollicking, action-packed, good time, full of humor and you know, just great creature design. That's on Peacock?
Amazon Prime.
Oh, even much easier to access than Peacock.
That one really won me over. I was not expecting much from that show, and I was burned by Westworld. Two of the creators of the show were the showrunners of Westworld, so I was like, oh, great, another like over-serious, you know, big budget thing.
Ponderous, you know, meditation on the nature of reality. But no.
No, I think they learned their lesson. I think this is a much more fun show that doesn't take itself as seriously. I think they had a blast, so to speak, making this. So, yeah.
That's a little nuclear apocalypse palate cleanser for you, Fallout on Amazon Prime. Omar Gayaga, thank you so much.
Thanks, Dale. Appreciate it.
When does an empire die? Does it collapse in one terrible moment? No, no.
Is this society, is this way we're living, the only one that's available to us? And when we ask these questions, when there's a dialogue about them, that basically is a utopia.
This year, as every year, Stephen Garrett is in France for the Cannes Film Festival, the Cannes Film
bonsoir.
Festival.
Bonsoir à tous.
Bonsoir.
Je suis ici.
Bonsoir, Stephen. Yeah, your French is impeccable. Right. You're once again living the hard knock life. You're just returning from a beach party.
I was at a beach party. Yeah.
With like, was it like an Annette Funicello and Frankie Avalon kind of back to the beach party?
Beach blanket. No, it was just a lot of, you know, kind of lukewarm rosé and flat beer.
It sounds like you're in the south of France. But this year's big event at the Cannes Film Festival was the world premiere of Francis Ford Coppola's self-financed and long-awaited epic Megalopolis. And you have seen Megalopolis, and we have posted your first take on it on the website. And I got to say, it sounds very hilariously bad.
It's all over the place, man. It is all over the place. I mean, the guy's heart is in the right place, and he clearly, this is a passion project. I think he started thinking about it after Apocalypse Now, right? So, or no, after One from a Heart.
That was a long time ago.
I think there should be a sort of expiration date for passion projects that just stay too long. But that said, man, he follows through. You know, it's kind of, you know,
it's big.
He had a press conference today, and I went to the press conference, and it was delightful. He kind of won the room over just because he's so generous and so charming and so sincere. I mean, very sincerely committed to taking risks. And, you know, if you take a risk, you risk failing. And he is fearless about that. And they talked about, you know, like, what is his legacy? He was like, look, on my deathbed, am I going to have any regrets? No, I'm going to say, look what I did. I got to do this. I got to do that. I got to make Megalopolis the way I wanted to. Guy's got no shits to give. You know what I mean? Like, he's living on his own terms, and he has no regrets.
It's interesting because, you know, of that generation of, you know, filmmakers from the 1970s, you know, Scorsese and Spielberg just keep cranking out movie after movie. It's been a long time since there's been a Francis Ford Coppola movie, right?
It's been a while. I mean, there was maybe three like a cluster of three, Twixt and Tetro and Youth Without Youth. And they all came kind of between 2007 and 2011, I think, something like that.
I haven't even heard of any of those movies. And I'm a Rotten Tomatoes approved film critic. But what I'm saying is, well, there was a time where you mentioned Scorsese, Coppola, and Spielberg all in the same breath. And I just feel like, you know, Coppola, he's obviously been very busy trying to get Megalopolis made.
Yeah, but then also kind of, I guess, looking at the and also re-editing Apocalypse Now and re-editing Cotton Club, and, you know, mm-hmm. and somebody asked him about that. They said, are you going to re-edit Megalopolis in a few years? And he's like, I don't know. He's like, look, I plan to be back in Cannes 20 years from now with another movie. He said
that would make him 100 years old.
Yeah, exactly. 105, because he's 85 here.
Right. So younger than Clint Eastwood is today.
I mean, if anybody can do it, man, I believe he can. He's got some serious willpower. But he did say, he was like, look, I re-edited those movies because I own those movies, so I can re-edit them. He's like, I don't own The Conversation, but I'm also happy with that edit. I wouldn't, you know, play around with it. He was like, I own Apocalypse Now because nobody wanted to buy it. So he's like, could I re-edit Megalopolis? Sure. I mean, it's mine. I think his whole thing is, I own it, so let me do it. You know?
All right, well, let's talk about the movie. So it is a it's a dystopian fantasy set in sort of an alternate past, right? It's where, because as you describe it, this is not, it's set in a America that is teetering on the brink, but there are no cell phones, there are no computers to speak of.
Well, I think that's him, you know, this is a 45-year-old script, so maybe it just isn't as hip to things like, you know, like smartphones as it could be. I think it's meant to be an alternate reality. It's not a past necessarily, because there's a lot of futuristic stuff in it. And it's not so much dystopic as it is just, you know, an empire in decline. And I think this is his meditation on the possibilities of looking forward and rethinking how we live as a civilization and how we live in cities. You know, it's kind of Robert Moses, you know, I guess spliced together with who is his nemesis? The woman who lived down in the village.
Oh, Jane Jacobs.
It's like Jane Jacobs. It's like splicing together the power of Moses and then the aspiration of Jane Jacobs is basically Adam Driver in a nutshell, plus crossed with Elon Musk, because he has created this kind of adamantium type metal called Megalon. AKA Megalopolis, right? Megalon, which is this futuristic material that is going to save the world and also makes really cool dresses for pop stars to wear, because that's another weird thing that happens in this movie. The movie definitely has a good sense of humor about itself, but it veers on campy at a certain point, just because I think the actors don't quite know what to do with it. Aubrey Plaza knows what kind of movie she's in, and she plays it to the hilt, you know, as does Shia LaBeouf, you know.
Are you sure Shia LaBeouf knows what movie he's in? He doesn't really seem to know what day it is when you hear him talk. So, but maybe he does. Maybe he does. I mean, I will give you Aubrey Plaza. She is a master of camp. She knows. She's a great actor, and she's, you know, this is her time. Look, I mean, from the stuff you put in your review, I obviously have not seen that yet because I'm trapped in Texas. I'm on house arrest right now in Texas. while you're in France, you know, there's just some of the lines just sound like really over the top and really silly and really, you know, and some of it reminded me of the sort of out of controlness of, like, obviously it's a different kind of movie, but of Damien Chazelle's Babylon, you know, one of these long,
right,
you know, epics, you know, for a director who no one will say no to it. No one's going to say no to Francis Ford Coppola because he literally financed this movie himself.
I mean, he absolutely did. I mean, that was something that somebody else brought up too, and he addressed it very patiently. He said, look, you know, this is in a nutshell, basically, he basically sold enough of his vineyard to bankroll this himself. But he explained the vineyard he didn't even own before the financial crisis of 2008, and he took out a $20 million line of credit in order to buy this vineyard. And he was just thinking, I'm going to buy something that I can, you know, invite my children and grandchildren to and hang out. It'll be like the Tivoli Gardens. And it was a big success, and other people had emulated what I did, and it ended up being very successful. So basically, this is found money for him. You know, it didn't exist 15 years ago, but this idea has existed for over 40 years. So for him, it's a win-win. He's just like, why would anybody be angry that I spent this money on this? Because I'm not.
I'm not going to fault him, but the idea of an empire in decline from a 45-year-old script does have a certain kind of comic irony to it, because obviously the empire, did it decline in 45 years? Maybe, but it had to, you know, but it's still here. And did it decline in the way that Francis Ford Coppola thought it was going to?
Is the question. I mean, I think this is like one of those bank shots that, like, actually rips the fabric of the table and, like, the ball goes flying across the room. You know what I mean? But
yeah,
he took the shot and
breaks a window slams into the jukebox
and record scratch. Yeah. I mean, look, I can't fault him because also it is the movie that everyone is talking about, and everybody is going to continue to talk about it as it rolls out. And IMAX has already agreed to have enough screens globally to be available for, you know, whatever intrepid distributor wants to take it on, you know.
Well, I'm already semi excited to see it at least once.
Exactly. So, I think a lot of people will be. I think they'll be curious, generous, and then the knives will come out, and then they'll actually talk about the ideas in it. And I think that if that's the takeaway, I think Francis, as he insisted everybody call him at the press conference, don't call me Mr. Coppola. Call me Francis. Everybody calls me Francis. I mean, it was hilarious. It was very sweet. You can't not like him. I mean, everybody's kind of rooting for him. You know, he'll be back in 20 years. He said so.
Okay, Megalopolis 2. All right, so Stephen, now this is our only chance to talk to you about the film festival. So you've been there a few days now. Is there anything else of note that you want to mention to our global audience?
Exactly. Because it's a global audience, I'm going to bring up Yorgos Lanthimos, the bad boy Greek filmmaker who did so well at the Oscars. He's got Kinds of Kindness, which Fox Searchlight, I think, is going to be rolling out like in June. It's coming up pretty soon. I just saw that today. I would say that's one of the strongest things I've seen in competition so far, which there have only been maybe four or five movies, because it's still kind of early in the festival. I mean, Wednesday was the official kind of starting
mark. Right, and we're talking, for those of you who aren't aware, we're talking on Friday, so it's been a couple of days.
Yeah, it's been literally like 2 days of things unspooling. And
now, Kinds of Kindness, I've seen a preview for it. It looks, and certainly Poor Things was his Oscar winning and nominated movie. This looks a lot sort of more grounded than that.
Well, it's more grounded in the sense that he's actually using, it looks like it was mostly shot in and around maybe New Orleans, certainly in Louisiana. It's not like it doesn't seem like they built houses. These look like existing houses and towns. And these people are going, it's set in modern day. It's set in the real world. Although the stuff that happens is completely surreal, but, you know, it doesn't have the kind of art, you know, decor of Poor Things. And, but it has a lot of the actors who were in it. And purportedly he made this, I think, soon after, or maybe during, Poor Things, because there's a lot of overlap with people. So Emma Stone is in it, Willem Dafoe is in it, and they add Jesse Plemons. And it's a triptych, right? So it's three different stories, and they relate only insofar as they use the same actors, but they're all playing different roles. And it's kind of a fun thing to watch when an actor is going to pop up and what kind of role that actor is going to play. And it is, I mean, it's, I think what I love about his movies, you literally don't know what's going to happen scene to scene. And this was just as unpredictable. I don't think it quite sticks the landing, but it is a real thrill to watch. And that's saying something for like a 2-hour and 45-minute movie that ostensibly really doesn't have any sound. I mean, you know, not any like CGI. It's not Megalopolis. You know, it's basically just people talking in rooms, but it's weird. And great. So that, I think, is probably the strongest thing. Although, that said, it's still got its flaws. I think there was a movie called Bird that Andre Arnold did, which I think is that kind of like kitchen sink British realism, magical realism. It's the first time she's done stuff that actually has a little CGI in it. I won't say more than that, but it's really quite touching and very sweet. There's also this ridiculously bleak movie called Girl with the Needle, which is a Danish movie about basically pregnant women having unwanted children. Right after World War One. It is the bleakest. It is black and white. It is, you know, kind of Academy aspect ratio. It is square. It is suffocating. And it's, I mean, I almost started laughing how bleak it was. So it feels very European.
Not a date night film.
Not quite a date night film. Another that they had that was in competition is called Wild Diamond, which is a debut film. I forget the name of the filmmaker, but she's a French filmmaker. It's her first film. And it's basically about social media influencers and this woman who's, I think she's 19 and she's desperate to be an influencer. And she shakes her booty and really just objectifies and eroticizes her body like crazy in order to get attention. When in fact, she's actually a virgin and does not want, like feels very uncomfortable having any sort of intimacy. So it's a bit shallow. I wish it were deeper, but it has some resident kind of issues that it addresses. And I think it will probably travel overseas. I could see it playing in the States.
Sure. Okay. Well, so those are the movies you've seen. That's what you've seen so far.
That's what I've seen. Well, that's the competition stuff. That's what we'll be hearing about. Oh, there's also an A24 film called Unbecoming a Guinea Fowl. Unbecoming a Guinea Fowl. It's a tongue twistery film from Zambia, I think. It's by, and again, I forget her name, but it's a filmmaker who had a movie called I Am Not a Witch, and it is about... It's funny and strange and odd and completely heartbreaking. And it deals with basically incest, like sexual molestation within a family. And it's tied to a funeral. And it's really quietly powerful. And that will be coming out in the States. You'll be seeing that sometime soon, probably before the end of the year.
Wow. So you are you're really just seeing movies there.
Pretty much just seeing movies. Going to film festival, and drinking a lot of like warm rosé at 1 a.m. on a beach.
All right. Well,
glamorous.
It does not sound like hell. I saw the Amy Winehouse biopic today.
Oh yeah, how was that?
You know,
did you talk about it yet?
No, we'll chat about it real quick here. I found the young woman who played Amy Winehouse to be very compelling. She does her own singing in the movie, and those scenes, the musical, and she's very good. And so the musical scenes are very good. I mean, you know, it was not. It's getting bad reviews. I thought it was actually like a pretty good, sweet film. They did, you know, they were very kind to her like she's from a big loving Jewish family in London, and they treated that material. They skipped over a lot of stuff. You didn't really see her creating music. There was a lot of intimating that she was having trouble with her nasty husband, but they kind of skipped over the Sid and Nancy fighting scenes. For the most part, so there was a lot of saying things were happening without showing things were happening, and a lot of scenes of her just kind of walking around the streets, drunk, brooding, and smoking. But it is Amy Winehouse. It's not bad. And if you like the music that it's about, then I think it will be satisfying. However, you know, there were two good Amy Winehouse documentaries a few years ago.
They were very good,
you know. Yeah, and this is not as good as either of those. Although I don't have the name of the woman who played Amy Winehouse in front of me, but she was very compelling, and it was an excellent performance. So there is that.
I've heard it's good. Yeah, that's
cool. There is it. That's what I did today, Stephen. I also watched Jeopardy, but we don't have to talk about that. I wish you safe film going and rosé drinking. In Cannes, and we will be back with you next week to not talk about Cannes, but to talk about the probably the most awaited movie of the summer, or one of the most awaited movies of the summer, Furiosa, a Mad Max story. It's coming. It's coming, but you guys are going to have to wait a week to talk about that. Bon voyage. Au revoir. A Wiedersehen. Stephen Garrett.
Merci bien. As they say, bon sales.
Bon sales. Have a good
happy screening.
Have a good seance. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, bye.
All right, thank you, Stephen. Thank you once again for suffering for your film critic's art by spending several days, 10 days or so, in France to watch movies and go to beach parties. It's a hard, dark life for Stephen. We can only hope that someday he will get the redemption that he deserves. Also, thanks to Omar Gayaga for talking to me about nuclear war as a scenario and Fallout on Amazon Prime, which is a very unlikely scenario of what would happen in a nuclear war, but it is a fun TV show to watch and enjoy. I am Neil Pollack. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. Thanks for reading the site and listening to the show, and I will talk to you next week.
Original production.